Dr. McLaughlin, I've heard concern expressed that in the urgency to get this vaccine prepared, people in the general public, they might have a perception that the vaccine hasn't been prepared carefully or tested thoroughly. What are your thoughts on that?
That is certainly one of our most common questions that comes up. How safe is the H1N1 vaccine? The good news with this vaccine, and this is a point that I really want people to listen to, is that this vaccine is made the exact same way as seasonal influenza vaccine. Seasonal influenza vaccine is by far and away one of our safest vaccines that we have, and it has been administered to hundreds of millions of people across the globe for decades. We've been using seasonal influenza vaccine for over three decades worldwide. It is one of our safest vaccines, and this H1N1 vaccine is made the exact same way. So it has also undergone clinical trial testing, vaccine efficacy trial testing. So far, the vaccine safety profiles are looking exactly the same as seasonal influenza vaccine. So that's really, really good news.
What's the reason for the delay in its availability to the more general populations?
One of the things that's important for folks to keep in mind is that it usually takes at least 6 months from the time that the virus is isolated by CDC to the point where we actually can develop a vaccine. Now, the virus strain first emerged in April of this year. The original projections that CDC was providing nationally were based on sort of a median time estimate in terms of how long it would take to get a certain quantity of vaccine out to the public. One of the things that we're seeing with this H1N1 virus is that the virus is growing a little bit slower than other influenza virus strains typically grow in the chick eggs. These are chicken eggs. And so that's part of the reason why we have not received as much vaccine as we were originally told that we were going to receive.
So it's a vaccine that just takes longer to make.
It takes a little bit longer to make.
Back in April, Dr. McLaughlin, you probably remember with some chagrin that the media got hold of H1N1 swine flu, and that's when the word pandemic, first started to circulate. What's the difference between a pandemic and an epidemic, and why is this word being used in conjunction with this particular H1N1 strain?
So an epidemic basically characterizes an outbreak of a disease, and it's almost, you know, most commonly used in reference to an infectious disease. So an outbreak of an infectious disease that is localized to a community or either within one state, or it could be a multi-state, I'm talking in the United States, a multi-state outbreak that involves many states. And an outbreak is basically when the incidence of the disease is well above what we would consider to be a baseline incidence for that particular disease, let's say influenza, for a given time period in a given location. Pandemic occurs when you have an epidemic that is of massive proportion, and it affects not only one country, but it affects multiple countries on multiple continents, and it involves a large number of people. So it's the definition is a little bit sort of fuzzy. There's no sort of distinct threshold above which one can say this was not an epidemic or pandemic yesterday, but it is today. But it's more a sense of how widespread is the epidemic and how many continents and how many people have been affected.
Is the severity of the disease, the severity of the symptoms, a factor in whether or not it's called a pandemic?
With respect to influenza, there's actually something we call a pandemic severity index. And the index goes from Category 1 to Category 5. A Category 1 pandemic for influenza is considered to be on par with, in terms of severity, with what we see with seasonal influenza every winter. And our current pandemic strain, the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, is considered to be a Category 1 pandemic at this time. Now, an example of a Category 5 pandemic, which is the most severe pandemic, would be the 1918 influenza pandemic that killed upwards of 50 to 60 million people globally. And so that would be the most severe category of an influenza pandemic.
What's the difference between a 1918 pandemic and the current H1N1 pandemic? Is it just the genetic makeup of the virus and its interaction with humans, or is the fact that vaccines and immunizations are more prevalent now? Has public health intervention actually mitigated this kind of pandemic?
Yes. The real characteristics that define a Category 1 pandemic versus a more severe pandemic like a Category 4 or 5 include the case fatality ratio, which is the number of people who die from the disease divided by the number who get ill, the percent of the population that actually becomes ill, and the total potential number of deaths associated with the pandemic. So illness rates play a large role in determining the pandemic severity index, and certainly in societies that have better medical care, and nowadays we have a vaccine that is becoming available. We also have antiviral medications. We also have much better medical technology. We have ventilators for people who go into severe respiratory failure. So all those things can play a role in assisting with the determination of the pandemic severity index.
It's not unreasonable to expect that if a 1918-style virus emerged, that it would not be quite as devastating as it was in 1918.
Correct, because we would have vaccine available, we'd have antiviral drugs, and we'd have better medical care. But certainly we know that there is a difference genetically between different strains of influenza virus. There are strains of influenza virus that cause milder disease, and there are strains of influenza virus that cause more severe disease. A good example is take a look at, remember bird flu, the H5N1?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big topic of discussion for quite a while. It still is circulating, and we are still hearing about some cases of bird flu that happened. But, you know, I think the last I checked, there were upwards of 200 to 300 cases globally that had been identified, and about 50% of the people who got the bird flu died from it. But the good news about the bird flu is that it does not transfer well from human to human. And so although it's a very severe influenza infection, it doesn't transmit well from human to human, and so we've only seen a very small number of cases of bird flu worldwide, whereas this 2009 H1N1 infection has spread, you know, throughout the globe. We've had tens of millions of cases in the United States already, and fortunately, the vast majority of cases have been relatively mild. That said, there are a number of patients who have been admitted to hospitals, many who have been admitted to intensive care units, and CDC is estimating that there have been thousands of people who have already died from this H1N1 infection. Another thing that's really important for folks to keep in mind is with influenza, there are about 36,000 people every year who die in the United States alone as a result of seasonal influenza infection.
Sometimes that number is overlooked, that just the regular seasonal flu can be deadly for people with underlying health concerns.
Primarily, but it can also affect folks who don't have underlying medical conditions, and they can become severely ill, and people do die from influenza without any known underlying medical conditions. You know, it's just one of those things that I think it's important for people to keep into their perspective. Influenza and pneumonia are in the top 10 leading causes of death in the United States, and that's something that I think a lot of people don't really realize. And as I said, 36,000 people die from influenza in the United States every year. And by comparison, About 15,000 people die from HIV/AIDS every year in the United States.
Is there any sort of consistent trend in the questions you've been hearing from Alaskans? Any common concerns that you want to share with our audience in Sitka?
You know, I think the biggest concern that keeps coming up for people is how safe is the H1N1 vaccine? And the good news is that this is one of our safest vaccines. It's made the exact same way as seasonal influenza vaccine is made. And we really, really encourage folks to go out and get vaccinated. It is by far and away the best way to prevent influenza infection, and it's important for folks to remember that influenza infection can be very severe even if you don't have underlying medical conditions that put you at increased risk for severe illness.
I suppose I couldn't have a conversation with a healthcare professional about this topic without you reminding us to wash our hands all the time.
Well, that's always my closing case, is that first of all, the best thing to do is to get vaccinated, and then also there are other precautions you can take to prevent influenza infection. One is to wash your hands frequently. Number two, cover your cough and sneezes if you do become ill. Don't touch your eyes, nose, or mouth without washing your hands first. That's a great way to spread influenza and other infections. Also, clean commonly touched surfaces, because that influenza virus can linger on hard surfaces and as well as other surfaces for up to 8 hours. So somebody who sneezes on a doorknob and you come by and touch that doorknob, you could become infected if you touch your eyes, nose, or mouth without washing your hands first. Clean those commonly touched surfaces. And then finally, if you do become ill, please stay home for at least 24 hours after resolution of fever.
I'm going to go wash my hands right now.
All right. Excellent.
Dr. McLaughlin, thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us and spreading this message across the state.
You're welcome. And I just want to say thanks so much to Penny Lehman and Joy Almquist, the public health nursing staff there in Sitka. I know they're doing a lot of hard work and trying to get folks vaccinated as well as providing public education. So hats off to them.